Hello everyone and welcome to Margaret Beaufort, episode 14, Rebel. Buckingham was having doubts about supporting Richard, though it's not entirely clear why, given the gold and goodies with which he had been showered so far. There are a couple of possibilities, and these possibilities may be connected with the presence of Dr. John Morton. John Morton was the Bishop of Ely and was one of the many of Edward IV's councillors who had fallen under the suspicions of good King Richard when he seized the throne. But cutting the head off a bishop was not straightforward, not even for Richard. So, rather than remove said organ, Richard had sent him home in the care of the man that he could trust more than life itself, his partner in crime, Buckingham. In the summer of 1483, after what we might agree had been a very busy year, Richard went north to the homeland of Yorkshire, land of the free as it's known, as well as the land of dripping, to see his son Edward. 9 years old, Edward was given a chariot to ride in to meet his dad, which sounds like every nine-year-old's dream to me. Buckingham, meanwhile, went home to Brecknock in Wales. There, Morton started to mess with his head. Morton probably worried aloud about, what will people think about Richard's usurpation, I wonder? Gosh, he might have suggested. The gentry south of the Thames, they really loved Edward IV very much. They loved their roles in his household. Now they've got nothing to do, poor dears, hanging around at home. Well, I figure they must be seriously grumpy, and I bet they're up in arms about whatever's happened to the son of their king. Not that I'm accusing Richard of anything, you understand. But you know how people talk. But, he might have sighed heavily, there are many of them. They have no leader. So, maybe Richard can afford not to worry, but if a leader appeared, well, things could get nasty, you know. And then Morton may have pointed out, there are all those Woodville lot. The Queen and her family, they have a big affinity. And the Woodvilles and the Greys, and they must be seriously upset. Given the right leadership, Richard had better be careful and watch his back. Morton might also just possibly perhaps have happened to casually mention Henry Tudor and Jasper too. Richard himself had in fact started to turn his head towards Henry and Duke Francis in Brittany. He'd briefed his envoy to start discussions with Francis, and although Henry was not specifically targeted, it does seem the topic did get raised in discussion. And then Francis began playing his trump card with enthusiasm. Oh, he said, I have the King of France constantly in my lugs about that Henry Tudor chappie. He's making me fantastic offers. I have a good mind to let him go to France. As it happens, said King of France died in August 1483, which rather took the pressure off Richard. But meanwhile, Morton was able to explain to Buckingham that, look, Henry could appear at any moment with the support of either Brittany or France. Richard had better be scared of that too. So Buckingham must now have been in a right old paddy, and it appears that he had rather taken Morton to his heart, for Morton later appeared by his side as his counsellor. And so now silver-tongued Morton dropped the last bit of poison. Buckingham himself later explained that Morton had reminded them that, oh, you know what? I'd forgotten that you yourself, you have a claim to the throne. You're descended from John of Gaunt. Now, I might tell you, gentle listeners, that the chance that Buckingham had at any point in his life forgotten this would be precisely zero, zip, a non-chance that had shuffled off this mortal coil and gone to meet its maker. 14th century nobles did ancestry. Big time. But there we go. Buckingham's pretty little head had been comprehensively turned. Now at this point, you're probably wondering, I thought it was Margaret who was supposed to be the spinner of plots. Well, Margaret was indeed ploughing the field of rebellion, but she was working a different strip. She could herself bring rebels to stand on the headland. Her relative John Wells and other lords such as Thomas Lewknor, John Cheney, John Heron. but it would not be enough. So she had another target. This target was incarcerated in Westminster Abbey's sanctuary, the Queen, Elizabeth Woodville. By this stage, Elizabeth would probably have been pretty desperate. No one likes to be trapped in a church for more than an hour, however good the sermon. It was probably dawning on her that her two boys' lives were either in danger or indeed already lost. And since Richard had persuaded her to give up her younger boy to his care, that must have driven her mad with agony. Elizabeth stood at the head of an extensive affinity. She could in particular bring Thomas Grey, the Marquis of Dorset, to the table, and Lionel, the Bishop of Salisbury. So, if she could be persuaded to join the rebellion, her support could swing it. But how to have that conversation? One does not just walk into Westminster Abbey. Or not to go a-plotting with Elizabeth Woodville, you don't. It just so happened, though, that Margaret, being one of the tippy-top of the elite, used one of the very tippy-top physicians in England, whose name was Dr. Lewis of Caerleon. Another of Dr. Lewis's clients was, spookily enough, Elizabeth Woodville. Everyone was used to Dr. Lewis's face around Westminster, and so Margaret took a risk and took Lewis into her confidence. And to her relief, she found him ready to conspire. Lewis took a proposition of alliance to Elizabeth. If she supported the rebellion against Richard III in favour of Margaret's boy, Henry Tudor, succeeding to the throne, she would commit to a royal mariage. Elizabeth's eldest daughter, also called Elizabeth, Elizabeth of York, let's call her, to Henry Tudor. So, if all went smoothly, Elizabeth of York would be queen. Woodville really didn't have much going for her as it was, and so she agreed to roll the dice and agreed to recruit as many as she could to the cause. Margaret then enlisted her faithful and long-time servant, Reginald Bray, a man very close to her, but with the personal authority to be able to talk to gentry families. Bray urgently started conversations, recruiting members of Edward IV's household like Giles Daubeny, Richard Guildford, and others. Meanwhile, Margaret was desperate to get Henry into the loop, and had the perfect man for the job, a cleric called Christopher Urswick, who had probably come into her patronage via Stanley. Urswick was being primed to get his bottom over to Brittany and get Henry to sign up to the marriage idea, and for he, in his turn, to bring his own bottom over to England to lead the rebellion and claim the throne of England as his birthright. Before Urswick could leave, however, John Morton got in touch with Margaret, and he urged her to send Bray to Wales, where he could meet Buckingham as well. So it's not exactly clear how it all happened, but somehow Buckingham and Margaret got to hear that they were both plotting at the same time, and they really should get it together. There was, of course, an elephant in the room, and that elephant was called Who's Going to Be King Then? We do not know what deal was struck, but the balance of opinion seems to be that there was hoodwinking going on, ladies and gentlemen, hoodwinking, and that the winker behind the hood was Margaret, who led Buckingham to believe that he would wear the crown. In Brittany, meanwhile, a different envoy did arrive from Margaret, one Hugh Conway, and he brought with him for Henry a good deal of money. Henry had approached Duke Francis and asked for aid. Despite Richard's advances, Francis saw the benefit in having the new King of England in his debt, in addition to which Henry now came with money. So he agreed to fit him out with ships and with troops. Henry sent word back to Blighty, and it seems that by the 24th of September, Henry and Jasper had heard directly from Buckingham. There would be two centres for this rebellion, Buckingham's estates in Wales, calling out his affinity and his tenants, and the south of England, starting in Kent. Meanwhile, Henry would sail and land, probably in Devon in the southwest. And Henry did indeed set sail in the 3rd of October, but the weather was not kind. Nevertheless, he tried again, though he'd been looking worriedly at his watch, fearing he'd missed the whole event. But this time he managed to make it over the channel, although he was blown off course eastward towards Poole in Dorset. There, soon after the 18th of October, he saw a crowd of soldiers on the beach. He sent some of his own men to investigate, and they were greeted with good news. Yes, yes, come ashore. The rebellion is working like a dream. In fact, the rebellion was not working like a dream, or at least it was from a Ricardian point of view. There seemed to have been just too many moving parts, and somewhere along the line, one of those moving parts was squeaky. So, Richard knew something was up and had the time to issue commissions of array in multiple counties in the west. Meanwhile, the risings in Kent and the south of England went off half-cock and were poorly coordinated. And while Richard had kept his eyes firmly on the main man, Buckingham, his trusty lieutenant, the Duke of Norfolk, dealt efficiently and successfully with the southern counties. Meanwhile, the heavens had decided to teach Buckingham two lessons. The first is that if you're planning anything from, I don't know, a family picnic, or let's say a rebellion involving marching hundreds of miles to defeat a usurping monarch, costing hundreds of lives in the process, don't trust the British weather, and particularly the Welsh weather, which makes England look like the Sahara by comparison. The heavens opened. The River Severn rose, and Buckingham's loyal tenantry floundered in the mud. Richard's agents had also done a good job. As Richard and his main force approached Salisbury, Thomas Vaughan had already captured Brecon Castle, and Humphrey Stafford had wrecked key bridges over the Severn, leaving Buckingham unable to cross into England. The second lesson was that Buckingham should have been reading his Bible, where he would have read that, "For whatever a man sows, this he will also reap." Buckingham was a hard-driving, exploitative landowner, and his tenants roundly hated him. So, rather few came to join him and John Morton. And when things went swimmingly in terms of rain and mud, they legged it. A crash of drums, a flash of light, and Buckingham's golden coat flew out of sight, and he was left alone. Looking at all the options and future scenarios, Buckingham decided to run away. He was, however, quickly found and caught and taken to Richard's camp at Salisbury, where he begged to be able to talk to his old partner in crime. Richard requested only that he talk to his hand, and Buckingham was executed in Salisbury on the 2nd of November. Let's return then to Poole Harbour on the south coast and Henry and his welcoming committee. According to his biographers, Henry showed excellent judgment, supposedly around the 20th October, let's say, in suspecting the intentions of these men of Dorset, who were indeed actually disreputable, dishonest types who really wanted to capture him and take him to their leader, Richard III. So Henry sailed away with his small force, ending up back in Normandy. Now, given the date, which is just about when Buckingham was raising his army and had yet to crash and burn, wouldn't it be fair to say that Henry, rather than being a model of sagacity, was something of a model of wimpiness? As far as he knew, the game was still in play on the 20th of October. His loyal partners in rebellion were out there risking their lives, and he sailed off at the first sign of trouble for a nice cup of tea and a bun. Not sure I'd have been very pleased were I a rebel. However, one biographer, S.J. Gunn, gives a later date, the 30th of October, for Henry's arrival. So let's save Henry's blushes, shall we, and assume that it was indeed this later date, since by then the die would indeed have been cast. Interestingly, Henry ended up in Normandy rather than Brittany, that channel crossing again. Tusk. I say interesting because it meant he had to ask Charles VIII of France for the right to cross his lands to walk back to Brittany. Which Charles did, actually, with quite a lot of goodwill and a bit of cash to make the journey more pleasant. Henry continued on back to Brittany, though, suggesting that he very much trusted Duke Francis now, which might actually prove to be a mistake. But both Francis and Charles VIII clearly thought that having a pretender trying to cause trouble in the land of the old enemy was generally a pretty fab idea. So, where was Margaret in all of this? We don't know where she was physically, maybe London, or more likely the northwest. But what we do know is that her husband wasn't with her. The domestic arrangements of Stanley and Margaret are most intriguing to me. So on this occasion, Stanley remained loyal to Richard and was with him at Salisbury, Did he and Margaret have a plan which involved Stanley being the decoy while Margaret plotted? Or did Margaret keep all of this plotting quiet somehow, even from Stanley, which would seem tricky to be fair, but maybe not impossible? It seems that Richard didn't know immediately about Margaret's role, but he soon did. And if John Fisher was correct about her being a bit of a worrywart and expecting the worst and planning for the frankly catastrophic, she'd have presumably been chewing her nails. Her partners in crime either fled, like John Morton and the Marquis of Dorset, or took sanctuary, like Elizabeth, or were arrested and thrown in the chokey, like the go-between, Dr. Lewis. Quite probably, Margaret had an idea of what was coming through her husband, but it all became clear in the January 1481 Parliament. Bills of attainder were passed against all the major rebels, Morton, Dorset, Wells, and of course, Henry Tudor. Margaret had her very own condemnation, and even if Richard was bigging things up, the charge list was extensive. Communicating with Henry, spreading money around to foment rebellion, plotting the destruction of the king. Now, there has been some debate about the severity of the punishment then meted out to Margaret. It has been described on the one hand as surprisingly lenient, but also, on the other hand, as very much the opposite, excessively severe. A later servant wrote, "In King Richard's days, she was often in jeopardy of her life, and yet she bare patiently all trouble in such wise." But was Margaret really in jeopardy of her life? Despite the dramatic leap in political revenge and execution through the Wars of the Roses, women were almost never executed. In fact, I'm struggling to remember any. Margaret was probably in no danger at any point of execution. In addition, of course, Stanley was in high favour with Richard, being showered with new offices in gratitude for staying by his side. So the conversation, "Thanks, Stanley, for staying loyal to me. Oh, by the way, I've executed your wife," is difficult to visualise. In that context, Margaret's punishment was pretty tough. All her lands were taken from her and given to her husband. If Stanley were to die, Margaret would very probably have been required to kiss them goodbye permanently. The one mercy, really, was that she was not incarcerated in the Tower or some such, but was allowed to be put under confinement by her husband at Knowsley and Latham, probably. But she was also not allowed to travel. All of this was not life-threatening, but it was enormously humiliating. All her life, Margaret had managed to exercise control over her life and future in the context of all the constraints that she and other women faced. Now she was, by law with her name on it, to be made powerless, and indeed for any freedom of action entirely dependent on the attitude of her husband. She had been publicly disgraced and humiliated and shorn of control over her future. She may not have been in danger of death, but this would certainly count as the lowest point of her life. Next week, then, we will see if Margaret and indeed Henry can recover from this seemingly complete defeat.